So I have two really, really intense fears. One is heights, and the other is really large bodies of water. So flying a plane over an ocean is about the worst case scenario for me. And then I got hooked on Lost, the TV show where they make you watch the plane crash over the ocean like 20 times in the first two episodes, and it totally wrecked me. And so I read this book several years ago, and it gave me a metaphor that stuck with me from there on out. It's a guy named Don Miller, and he says, imagine that there's a plane crash at sea, and you've got this lifeboat there to try to rescue people, and the lifeboat can only hold six people. Six people get to survive in this lifeboat, and seven survive the crash. So now the seven people floating in the ocean waiting for rescue have a choice to make. Who gets voted out of the boat? And so you start going around, and they don't know how to make this decision, so they decide, hey, look, let's find out what each person's story is, what each person's life looks like, what they've got waiting for them back home. And then we will decide who is most needed to survive. Who has the most waiting for them, the most that would be lost if they were lost. And so you go around the circle and you start telling your story, trying to decide who gets to make it and who gets left behind. And Don Miller said, whether or not we realize it, most of us live our entire lives trying to prove that we deserve to be in the lifeboat. Waking up every day trying to show, hey, I deserve to be here. I belong. I have enough going for me that I'm really worth the space that I take up. And our paralyzing fear is, what if one day we don't? What if one day we don't make the cut? We don't belong. And so to tell you what this would look like, I'm going to tell you about a time when I didn't make it in the lifeboat. It is the worst semester of my life. It was sophomore year of high school. Okay, so let me tell you what sophomore year of high school was like for little Nick. Okay, so I had gone to junior high at a pretty small school, and I played football for this coach that was incredible. Okay? And so Springdale High hired this coach to come coach for them. So I decided, for a lot of reasons, one of them being football, that I was going to transfer to Springdale High from the tiny school before sophomore year. Okay, so I let coach know, hey, I'm transferring over. And he says, oh, good. No one over here knows how to run my offense. And so before the school year even starts, at the beginning of June, they would go take the team, the juniors and the seniors, the varsity team, to this team camp in Tulsa, which was basically just getting the fire beat out of you for 4 days in utter misery. And coach said, hey, Nick, no one knows the offense yet. I need you to come to varsity team camp. Now, that sounds like a good thing, right? You're a sophomore. You're the new kid. You're going to get pulled up to varsity. There's one really big problem. I was 5'9", 150 pounds. I had no business being on that field. There were four of us that got to go to varsity team camp. The other three would go on to be college football players or All-State and be really awesome. And then there was me. I had no business being there. The only reason he invited me to come was because I had played in his system the year before. So immediately I show up at team camp and all the older guys go, oh, I get it. You transferred. You played for coach before, so he just pulled you up to varsity without a single practice, didn't he? Now, I'm coming into my sophomore year wanting to get to know my peers, and what's their first impression of me? Before the first day of school, I'm already getting special treatment from the coach. So then the first day of school comes, and I go to the sophomore practice in the morning. And we had just, you know, Springdale cares a lot about sports, and we had just gotten this big, beautiful new locker room with like the NFL-style lockers. And at the first sophomore practice, there was this clumsy kid who got picked on a lot, and a couple of the stars of the team started whipping him with towels as he came out of the locker room. He tripped and fell and broke one of the brand new lockers. So coach hears the smash, comes downstairs, and says, what happened? And the team all points at the clumsy kid who's getting picked on and said, he kept on trying to pick fights with people and he tripped and broke a locker. Coach looks at him and goes, that what happens? And he looks around scared and goes, yes, sir, that's what happened. And he says, okay, meet me after practice. We'll run today. Everybody gets ready to leave. I feel kind of guilty about the lie, but I'm also really terrified about the position this puts me in with the new people I'm trying to get to know. So I hang back just a minute after everybody leaves and say, hey, coach, I don't really want to be a snitch, but I think you know that's not what happened, right? And he goes, yeah, I know. So I leave and go about my business feeling like I've done what I need to do. I walk into the cafeteria on my first day at Springdale High, and I kid you not, it was like something out of a movie. I walk into the cafeteria, and every face turns to look at me and glares. Like, what is going on? And so I get my tray and go to try to find a seat next to some of the football guys, and they go, hey, we hear what happened. I go, what are you talking about? They said, you stayed back in the locker room after we left, and coach has the name of everybody that was involved. Way to go, new kid. Now, to make matters worse, I had the classes that I wanted to take with a bunch of my friends, so I applied to get into those classes, and the teacher involved said, hey, we actually have a pretty intense AP program here at Springdale, and I don't think the school you came from really had it, so we think you need to kind of prove yourself for a year, so we're not going to let you in any of those classes. And then to make matters worse, is this sounding like a fun year to you? The guy I had to line up in practice each day was 6'4", 300 pounds. You remember how big I was? 5'9", 150. And he was having a bad year. So he just beat me up every day. The guy that I was backing up, who was one of the great players on the team, sprained his ankle. And so there's a chance I might have to actually play. And one of the seniors came to me and said, hey, rookie, I've been working for this my entire life. If you mess this up for me, I will slit your throat. So I spent all fall of my sophomore year sitting alone in a cafeteria, eating lunch by myself, and then from lunch on, sick at my stomach, knowing that I had to go football practice that afternoon. And I realized how much I absolutely did not belong. So you know what I did? I made a decision that I would never not belong again. So I determined that I was going to do everything I could academically to make sure I belonged in the best circles at Springdale High academically. I did everything I could musically to get in the best circles musically, and I worked my tail off to make sure that I belonged on that football team. Everything I did to make sure that I was never left out again like I was that fall semester of my sophomore year. I was telling this story to my wife and daughter this week, and my daughter looked at me and said, hey, Daddy, when did you figure out that was a bad idea? I said, about last year, maybe. Now, I know this is probably a pretty vulnerable place to be, to ask you right out of the gate at Fall Retreat, but I'm curious, what does that look like for you? What makes you worth having around? When you walk into a room, what makes you belong? And what kind of things do you do to prove that you belong? You see, Jesus came into a culture that was very much like this. The culture that Jesus lived in was called an honor and shame culture. And here's how it worked. The way you took care of bad behavior in an honor and shame culture was to make sure that everybody knew how bad you had failed, so that you would be such an outcast you'd never want to do it again. Now, for a long time when we would teach the Bible, we had to explain to people what that meant. Because America is not an honor shame culture, right? If people mess up in America, you go to court and you find out if you break the law and then you get a punishment. But something beautiful changed that a few years ago. You know what that is? It's called social media. How do we punish bad behavior now? Public shame. We do everything we can to make the people who have messed up look as bad as they can, and we are quickly going back to an honor-shame culture. So Jesus is speaking to people in small little villages where everybody always knew your mistakes, and where everybody is expected to constantly live up to the standards and the expectations of everyone around them to know that they belonged. And so it's to these people that Jesus is speaking to in Matthew chapter 11, verse 25. If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 11, that's where we're going to be. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 25, it says, "At that time, Jesus said, 'I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this is what you were pleased to do.'" So what Jesus is talking about is he's just talked about the kinds of people who have failed. He's talking about people who tried to do everything they could to earn their place, and they totally missed it. And he's proclaimed how bad they miss it. And then he says that there's some kind of secret, something that God has chosen to show to a surprising group of people. And he says, instead of showing it to the wise people, he showed it to kids. Now, another thing that's kind of weird about our culture compared to Jesus' culture, we think kids are kind of cute and we like them, right? And we generally think taking care of kids is an important thing. In Jesus' day, they really didn't care about kids. Kids were just a nuisance, and they didn't really matter until they became adults and they could actually start contributing something. And so what Jesus is doing here is he's saying, God, you're doing something special, and instead of showing it to the important people, you've chosen to show it to people who don't matter, to people who find themselves on the outside of the important circles. And what is that thing? Well, in verse 27, Jesus goes on. He says, "All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." So Jesus begins by saying that everything has been given to me by the Father. Now, I don't know if you've been around church circles much, but talking about God as the Father is something that's really common to us. It's a language that we use. We think of God as a father. We're all the children of God. But before Jesus came along, almost no one ever called God Father. Okay, if you go read the Old Testament, which is the part of the Bible that happens before Jesus, people aren't praying to God the Father. They don't call him Father. That's not part of how they know him. When they pray to God, the one who shot lightning down from the mountains. They pray to the God that wipes out the Assyrian army, right? That's the kind of God they prayed to, someone who is mighty and strong and powerful. Now, is that who God is? Absolutely, that's who God is. And so something really strange starts to happen when Jesus shows up. Nobody's been calling God Father, and Jesus starts showing up and praying to God, but calling him Father. How can he do that? What does he mean by that? Well, he explains it right here. The reason he can call God Father is because he is the Son. You see, the reason they didn't call God Father in the Old Testament is because no one had the right to call him Father. That they weren't his children. They weren't his sons and daughters. They were his creation. So Jesus is saying there's something different about him. There's something that makes him different from everyone else who's ever lived. He's saying, I know God a way that you never have. No one really knows the Father like I do. I was listening, I'm kind of a history nerd, and so I do these really nerdy things, and I listened to this podcast called Presidential a year ago that was this podcast that just goes through every president in history. And one of the most fascinating ones to me was the podcast on Gerald Ford, and they interviewed his son. And all of these podcasts are talking about these hugely important figures, and there's all these biographies and PhDs in history that are talking about him. And then here comes this guy that goes, yeah, man, I mean, Dad was so surprised when that happened. And it was really odd because he never called him the president. He never referred to his dad as the leader of the country. He just said, well, yeah, this is what Dad felt like when this was happening. You see, no matter how important Gerald Ford was, no role that man could ever have would trump what it was to be his son and to know that man as his father. Did he respect him as his president? Absolutely. But as son, he had a kind of intimacy with his father that was unlike anything else. He knew a side of his father that no one else knew. People who wrote PhD papers on Gerald Ford did not know that president the way his son did. He had a special inside track. And Jesus shows up and says, hey, I have a special inside track on God because I'm his son. And when Jesus did that, he struck at something that goes to the heart of who we are. There's something really special about this father-son relationship. One writer has said that it is the job of a father to give their child a sense of identity, to frame for a child who they are. And that's the unique role that a father gives. In fact, if you want to take a look at the special thing that happens in the relationship between a father and son, take a look at Ethan's story. Man, where are you at? Did you know that was happening tonight? Okay, you're kind of aware. Okay, good. Kind of aware is good enough for me to feel comfortable. Hey, what's so beautiful about that story is the powerful shaping influence that a father can have in your life. I mean, one psychologist says that all of psychology can basically be boiled down to where have I been, where am I right now, and where am I going? And if we don't know where we've been and where we are, we have no chance of figuring out where we're going. And it is the role of a father to help us understand where we've come from and who we are. I remember at one really important moment, I was really down and discouraged, particularly about work and what I was doing, and I felt like it was time to throw the towel in and do something else. And so I called my dad up, and I was kind of interested in what he did for a job. I said, hey, can we just grab lunch? And I just want to hear about your industry and what it would take for me to get in it. And he said, sure. And we sat down, we had lunch, and he answered a whole lot of questions and told me what it would take. And then at the end of the lunch, he said, hey, Nick, look, if you want to do what I do, you'd do great, and I will help you get there. But you're right where you belong right now. And I believe in what you're doing, and I really hope you don't stop. And that shifted everything for me to hear my father say that, to hear the confidence he had in me in that moment. Now, here's where I can imagine for some people in this room, these really sweet father stories are striking a chord, because a lot of you don't have that. A lot of you in a place where a father should have been there to shape you, to help you know who you were, maybe you had a gaping hole. Maybe dad wasn't there at all. Or maybe you had a dad who was there, but instead of caring for you and shaping you, he actually hurt you and abused you and shamed you. Now here's what's transformative about what Jesus is doing in this moment. Whether you had an incredible dad or no dad at all, there's not a single person in this room who had a perfect dad. There's not a single person in this room who had a father who was able to instill in us everything we need to be safe and secure in life. And that's one of the many things that leaves us searching for our place in the lifeboat, trying to figure out, how do I fit here? And so Jesus is coming along just hinting at this beautiful idea that someone could actually know God as Father. And so out of this conversation, where he starts to introduce that there is a kind of relationship with God that no one's ever had before, the idea of knowing him as Father, something his people don't know about, he then turns his attention and gives a direct command to people. He says, come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Now, that seems odd to me that would be the next place he would go. After talking about what it's like to have this perfect father, he then says, hey, by the way, if you're exhausted and you're carrying more than you can bear, more than you are strong enough to carry, come to me and I'll give you rest. And he goes on from there and he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, when Jesus says yoke, I'm just going to go ahead and let the air out of the room. He's not talking about eggs. Okay? When Jesus talks about a yoke, he's talking about a farming term. And it would look like this. You see the wooden thing on their back? That is called a yoke. And what it would be is you would put this on the top of an animal and then strap it to something else. And that is how they carried heavy weights. So Jesus assumes that the reason these people are exhausted, tired, and worn out, sorry, Houston, is that they've had something put on them to carry that is too much for them to carry. And he says, hey, why don't we just trade what you're carrying? Why don't we just switch it out? Let me give you something else to carry. Something that's a little easier and a little bit lighter. So here's what I want you to chew on a little bit. And man, I know when I was where you are, I was not mature enough to answer the question that we're about to ask. I was not mature enough to ask the question, what are you carrying each day? Because you know what? It's a scary and vulnerable thing to actually admit where we're weak. We're assuming that you're trying to carry something that's too big for you, and I wasn't ready to admit it. When I came to weekends like this, my main goals were twofold. One, to look awesome at Frisbee and make sure that my Springdale Senior Cell group won Ultimate Frisbee, which we did. And secondly, to try to look as spiritual as I possibly could in cabin time. The last thing I wanted to do at this weekend was to look weak, to look like I didn't have it all together. And by the way, that's why I was exhausted, because I was constantly trying to hold it together. So I'm curious, what kinds of things are weighing you down? So maybe for you, it's like it was for me. Maybe it's sports. Maybe it is the competitive atmosphere of trying to live up to some expectations. Maybe for you, it's the expectations of your family. Isn't that a beautiful family? This one down here in the bottom right is my favorite. That person is just really, really excited to be here. Hey, maybe for you, it is the expectations of parents that are just crushing you. I can't tell you the number of times I've been in student ministry situations where I've talked to a student and they've been completely overwhelmed by something. And I thought, man, this is crushing them. I'm going to talk to their parents about it. And when I told their parents, it seems like your student is really overwhelmed with this thing. What they actually did is start talking about how important it was for them to be better at it. How important it was for them to be better at the grades that were overwhelming them. Maybe it's some family expectation. Maybe it's the fear of what's coming next with school. By the way, everybody knows that if you don't get into good enough ACT, you won't get into the right college, which means you won't be able to get a good job, which means you'll be lonely and poor forever, right? We've already covered that, right? But that's what you're told, isn't it? That your entire life depends on a test score to a paper, getting to college and getting the right degree and getting the right job. Do you know how miserable that is? To be told that the rest of your life depends on 3 hours of a test? And why any test lasts 3 hours, I don't know. If that's the highlight of the weekend, we have a problem. I didn't mean to go on an ACT rant. Hey, seniors, are you freaking out about next year just a little bit? Hey, did you know? I have not met somebody 20 years from where you are, 30 years from where you are, living in regret going, man, it all went wrong because of that test score. You're told that, aren't you? You're told that not getting the right test score in the right college is going to ruin everything. I've never heard someone in their 60s say it was that test. Never heard it. But you're carrying it. Hey, what about this one? You see, there was this fascinating thing that happened back in the 90s, okay? Were y'all alive in the 90s? No, okay, I didn't think so. Okay. Okay, so here is this fascinating thing that happened. It was really, really weird. So there was a special group of people called celebrities, And what would happen was people would try to take pictures of these celebrities eating dinner. And they would try to get a picture of what coffee shop they were going to and what their latte looked like so that a crowd of followers would know what latte they had that day. There was an entire group of photographers that tried to capture pictures of celebrities so that their followers would see their everyday life. And this very unique, special group of people had to worry about their image every moment of every day because their followers were going to be watching their every move. Do you realize that we have subjected all of ourselves to that kind of pressure? Constantly cultivating an image, constantly choosing to make sure that what people see from you is exactly what you want them to. Here's the irony of that. I don't know if this is as much a thing for you guys. It's a super thing, especially like in parenting world, as parents post like the really cool birthday party they threw for their kid that's like Pinterest perfect in every way. And so what happens is you post this amazing thing that shows how awesome you are, or like this really great picture of a family devotional where you're all loving each other and praying to Jesus. And every other parent's going, why is our family so wicked and evil? Ironically, everybody is posting this fake picture of themselves to show how great they are and somehow fooled by everybody else's fake pictures. And you're carrying this. You're carrying constantly trying to cultivate your image, constantly trying to show people what you want them to see from you. And here's the underlying fear. And I don't know if you're like me, but I can tell you what it was like for me all through high school. Someday everyone's going to find out. Someday everybody's going to find out what a fraud I am. Someday everybody's going to figure out that I don't measure up. Someday all the work that I've done is going to come crashing down. And it's to that moment in your life that Jesus looks at you and says, come to me. Come to me when you're tired and you're worn down carrying something you can't carry. It's to that moment that Jesus looks at you and says, hey, that weight that you've got on your back, let's go ahead and trade that out for a different one. I want you to carry what I've got. You want to know how that exchange works out? What does it look like to carry Jesus' yoke? You see, Jesus spent his entire ministry inviting people to come learn from him, to come walk with him. And then at the end, we find the moment that his entire story had been moving toward. As he goes in a garden to talk to that father that he told us about, that one that he was so close to, that God who gave him his identity, that showed him who he was. And he prays, he says, my father, if it's possible, will you take this cup from me? Yet not as I will, but what you will. Do you hear what's happening here? Jesus looked at a whole bunch of people who were carrying more than they could carry and says, hey, come to me. My yoke's easy. I'm not carrying too many burdens. Come on. Come to me. I'll make it easy for you. I'll take that burden off your shoulders. And yet here is Jesus, that one who tells us that he'll take the heavy burden, that thing that you can't carry, and here's him going to his father and saying, Father, I can't carry this. Please take it from me. But I trust you. I trust you. So they stripped him. And they put a scarlet robe on him. And then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand, and they knelt in front of him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews, they said. They spit on him, and they took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. They string him up on a cross, and hang him on display for everyone. Stripped completely naked, beaten and bloodied. And then he cries out. About 3 in the afternoon, he says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Remember, this is the Father, right? This is the one he knows so well. And he says, where'd you go? Why did you leave me here? I remember one night, it was one of the lowest moments of my life. It was a moment that I just felt completely abandoned, alone, and rejected. And I felt like giving up on life. I was done. I had never felt so broken. And those words came into my head, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I was about to pray that to God as if he had abandoned me. And then I don't get these moments hardly at all where God just like speaks straight to me. But before I could claim those words as my own, I was reminded who had said them. That these were the words of Jesus. And in that moment, it was as if God said directly to me, Nick, my son was abandoned on the cross so that you never will be. My son was mocked, beaten, and ashamed. My son lost his place on the lifeboat. My son didn't make the cut so that you would. There was this beautiful movie that came out a few years ago, and it was about a family. It was a jacked up family. They were really, really messed up. But the youngest daughter in the family had gotten into this beauty pageant. And so the whole family decides they're going to drive across the country to take her. And her grandpa had taught her a dance routine, and no one else in the family had ever seen it. And so they're all gathered at this beauty pageant, and there's all these just beautiful little kids with all their talents. And the daughter gets up on stage to do her dance, and it's atrocious. Like, it's awful. It's, like, awkward and embarrassing. It's like, you ever watch a show where you kind of want to hide and stop watching because it's so uncomfortable? That is this girl's dance routine. It's that bad. And the family sitting in the back panics for her and realizes, oh my gosh, all these perfect little kids and their parents are going to shred her. And you know what happens? Her teenage brother runs up on stage with her and starts dancing. And then her uncle runs up on stage and starts dancing. And then her dad runs up on stage and starts dancing. And while the entire room is infuriated and ashamed of what's happened to their beauty pageant, this little girl, who may have just had one of the most shaming moments of her life, instead has one of the most beautiful moments of her life, because she can't see the room laughing at her. All she can see is the people who matter most loving her and dancing with her. They stepped into the embarrassment with her. You scared of being rejected? Jesus took that for you. He was rejected and turned away by everyone who loved him. Have you been shamed? Have you been abused? Jesus was stripped naked and beaten. Have you been left alone? Jesus sat alone, completely abandoned, so that he could say, hey, come with me. I want to step into it with you. And he invites you to know him that way so that he can introduce you to his Father. And so wherever you're coming from, whether you've been walking with Jesus for a long time and somehow you've just forgotten, or maybe you don't know this person, Jesus, and you've never trusted him with your life. You've never been willing to make that exchange. Our prayer tonight is that you'd have the courage and the vulnerability to recognize what it is you're carrying that's too big for you and to let go of it and to come to know the one who says, hey, come to me and I'll give you rest. Lord, we love you. That is our prayer tonight. Lord, we need to know the Father. We need to know we belong. So would you make us a people who are transformed by the love of Jesus? Lord, would you give us the brokenness, the courage to be weak with each other tonight and to be weak with you, to come to the place where we say, I can't. I can't carry this anymore. I can't wear the mask. And Lord, let us meet your Son. Praise things in Jesus' name.